Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're talking to Susan Freeman and Tim Cunningham. Susan Freeman is a feminist theorist studying gender and sexuality and a professor in the University of Virginia's English department. She is the author of a new book, Extreme Domesticity, A View from the Margins, in which she challenges mainstream views of domesticity and explores the value of creating a safe space and homemaking for underrepresented groups such as immigrants, homeless, queers, and gender rebels. And we'll be talking with Tim Cunningham. Tim Cunningham has traveled to 13 countries delivering laughter to communities in crisis across the globe with Clowns Without Borders. The organization brings connection through playfulness to people affected by the ravages of natural disaster, disease, and war. He's a nurse professor, and he's also the director of the School of Nursing's Compassionate Care Initiative at the University of Virginia. We'll hear about his work, his travels, and how laughter improves health. Imagine we have over 100 people we've talked to, talented, scholarly, fascinating guests as amazing as these, talking about everything from fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. And my very good friend Nancy, are you there?
Here.
Excellent.
I'm dreaming of that very balanced cocktail after a week's events like this. But yeah, I'm here.
Yes.
I'm totally here. I can't believe all the stuff that Mr. Michael Cohen has been up to on behalf of America.
I just think that there's so much that, you know how, I hate to say this, but you know how there used to be the talk about, is it chess or checkers or whatever? First of all, it's not checkers, but there's so much going on that by the time it takes to get to the end of all this, untangling everything with the Mueller probe, you know, the public opinion, I'm worried about it.
Yeah, the length of it is very concerning, but I totally understand. There is so much, they've done so much illicit, corrupt behavior. They've entangled so many countries and financed illicitly so many things. I don't blame him, Mueller, for taking this long, because there's so much. I'm sure he had no idea when he started how bad it was.
I know. I feel like he's just going to have to make a call at some point and just say, "I've got enough, and this is enough." And
I wish. I agree. Yeah. I totally agree. I wish he would surface with some more. Some more witches to be indicted. You know, it's
right.
We did. You might have seen last night. It was later in the day, but Mr. Weinstein was arrested.
Oh yesterday. Yes, I did see that. And the NFL, the New York Times opinion said the NFL kneels to Trump, which was
It's terrible.
A great headline, and I just, it's like a form of idolatry, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question in my mind that he will, for those that wind up deciding to stay in the locker room while the anthem's playing, I know he's going to refer to them as animals, too. I mean, now that word is out, he's just going to throw it around. And we know him. We know what he's going to do. You know, he's so obvious. So that was not a one-off.
We're
going to hear it a lot whenever he feels like
threatening,
powerful,
to deport them. But the light at the end of the tunnel, not at the end of the tunnel, but a shining moment, is New York Jets chairman Christopher Johnson said he would not punish any player who protests. So I hope there's more that do that.
And you know, did you know that his, I think it's his brother, Jerry, mm-hmm. He's an ambassador. He's something in the Trump White House. He's like an ambassador.
Oh, really?
So it's his own brother that stuck his neck out.
Wow.
On the player's behalf. That was quite striking. Yeah. Yes. Regardless, it was refreshing. Yeah.
And in a bit of good news, Stacey Abrams became the first black woman to win a major party's nomination for governor in Georgia. And then Lupe Valdez became the first openly gay person and Hispanic woman to do the same in Texas. So we could...
That was...
There could be some good things happening. We could have the first black woman governor in the U.S., the first lesbian serving in Congress from Texas, the first Democrat woman representing Kentucky in the House, hopefully in these primary elections in the red state. So everybody everywhere, voting is so, so important while we still have the right to do it.
Oh, my God. I swear, I love summer, and I would give it up in a heartbeat for this to be November. I don't even care. I cannot get to Election Day fast enough because, as you said, I mean, he just knows he's unstoppable. You know, well, it's not him. It's not just him. That's the thing. It's not
right.
just him.
He's oh,
got
right.
entire Congress just
complicit.
You know, yeah.
This would have been so
Writing
over.
The democracy. Yeah,
if it were
totally.
Another party. And so,
cannot be understated.
Speaking of women, gender, I saw the movie RBG, and it's really great about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her career and how she worked to challenge gender discrimination for all genders. And related to that, this Tuesday, there's a screening of the movie at Violent Crown. It's being sponsored by... 100 Black Women of Charlottesville Now, and Women of the Fifth. So it's Tuesday, May 29th, and it is proceeds go to those organizations, and the movie starts at 7. You can find it online and on Invisible here in Charlottesville.
That sounds cool. I'm glad you got to see it.
Yeah.
You saw it early or no? You just saw it?
It's out here.
Gotcha.
It was really, it was good. And it's an interesting story. They interview her granddaughter, who's I believe at Harvard Law now. It's a good story all around.
She has to stay healthy. We need her. I mean, that's all I think about when you mention her name. That's the first thing I think of.
Yeah,
please,
for sure.
Please don't die. Please stay healthy.
I know. She looks so frail, but she works out every day. So with no further ado, I want to get to our first guest. She is Susan Freeman.
Hey, I just want to mention very quickly, though, that on it's coming up Tuesday. Starbucks is doing their sensitivity training thing. They're shutting down for that video. Yeah, it's coming up on 29th. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
And 8,000 stores, they're losing I forgot how many millions.
Yeah.
But so it's really the right thing to do. I'm so glad.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I did interrupt you.
Yeah, that's okay. So... Our first guest is Susan Freeman. She is a professor in UVA's English department, where she studies and teaches about gender and sexuality. She is focused on women's literature, writing frequently about Jane Austen, but also looks at popular culture. Her book, Cool Men and the Second Sex, is a feminist critique of artists, including Spike Lee, Quentin Tarantino, and Andrew Ross. She is the author of a new book, Extreme Domesticity, A View from the Margins, which looks at domesticity in underrepresented spheres, exploring the homemaking of immigrants, homeless, queers, and gender rebels. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so in your new book, Extreme Domesticity, what drove you to write it, and what did you want to achieve and show people?
So basically, as the title suggests, by putting together the idea of extremity with domesticity, I'm hoping to really shake up our usual ideas about the domestic, which is that it's not extreme, it's boring, nothing happens there, it's conservative, it's the site of traditional family values, traditional ideas about gender and family, and that it's a place of stability, if not stasis. So if you want something to happen, you've got to leave home. You've got to go on a journey. And I want to say, well, actually, they're journeys that take place in the home. And homes are incredibly diverse. They're incredibly complicated. Some are stable. Some conform to that stereotype. But many, many more are insecure. They're places of conflict. They're places of, you know, often poverty or hybridity, having to do with several generations of people from immigrant backgrounds. They're dynamic. And also they're places of work. that, again, we tend to think that nothing really happens in the home. But in fact, homes aren't just there. They have to be created every day and recreated. So one kind of inspiration for the book is Marxist feminist views that homes are places of labor where workers are reproduced, and then they can go out and be productive. But unless their bodies are cared for, you know, capitalism is going to stop. So we need to look at that unpaid or sometimes underpaid domestic labor that, what do you know, women are by and large shouldering the burden of. So, again, just to sort of challenge our sense of, you know, we tend to write off, and this is true on the left, too, that we sort of write off the domestic, you know, as somehow bound up with these conventional ideas. And I want to say, well, actually, no, they're queer households, and they're certainly precarious households.
Mm-hmm. Susan, what do you think the relationship is between our tending to minimize it and the fact that we don't literally value it? You know, they don't get paid, or they get paid so little, as you said. Are they, how, which came first, or does it matter?
Well, you know, I think that it's not coincidental that most of this care work, this kin work, this work cleaning and washing and sort of fighting against entropy, that is work that is done by women. And we know that even when it's out in the world, custodians who do that kind of work, well, Tim will speak about this more in a minute, but people who do different kinds of care work, including nurses, though that's work that is feminized and generally undervalued in our culture. And I think that that has to do with a gender bias. And we know that areas into which, you know, if whole occupations are feminized, what do you know, wages go down. Occupations that are dominated by men and associated with masculinity and masculine qualities, traditionally masculine qualities, those tend to be the high status and high paid areas. So I really am, I mean, that's the kind of feminist intervention. I don't mean, and I have to really stress, I don't mean like women should stay in the home and women are naturally homemakers. But I also feel that we have a really robust celebration of women who are on the road, women who are out of the house, women who are going out, you know, doing things around the world. And we also have a really robust feminist critique of ways that the home can be really a kind of carceral place for women. You know, people in literary studies look at Jane Eyre and look at, you know, Bertha Mason trapped in the attic. So I don't want to romanticize the domestic, and I want to keep in place that strong feminist critique of ways that domesticity has not served women well. It's a private space that also can hide domestic violence. But at the same time, I do want to really value the richness of domestic life. And it's something that everyone needs. Again, the feminist intervention has to do with redeeming something that has been coded as feminine and has been reliant on labor that is mostly literally done by women and therefore devalued.
So you explore the ethnographies of these different people I refer to on the margins. Can you talk about that and your experience there?
Yeah. So, you know, my book talks about novels like Gaskell's Mary Barton and Jamaica Kincaid's Lucy. But I also do look at the most extreme versions of domesticity. My sources are ethnographies and first-person accounts of homelessness. And you might think that to be homeless is to just lack domesticity. Like, how can you make a home if you don't have one? Well, in fact, it should be obvious if you think about it that not having reliable shelter actually means that you have to cobble together some version of domestic safety and comfort. And so when you look at these ethnographies, you know, one of the more extreme cases is a woman. It's a book called Natalie on the Street. And she has her shopping cart and she has her bundles. But she really tries to, those possessions are ways that she creates a kind of boundary. She puts them around herself on the sidewalk and marks off that space. So another example is a guy who travels with his dog. It's a book called Travels with Lisbeth by Lars Aigner. And he actually is very ingenious, you know, creating a sort of campsite and making a lamp out of oil that he finds in a dumpster. And his dog provides a kind of tactile sense of hominess that can travel with him. Another idea that we have about homeless people is not only do they are they sort of misfits and criminals and threats and don't have a home, as opposed to being homemakers as they once were and as we all are in some sense. There's also this idea that homeless people are disaffiliated. And there are people like Lars Aynier did travel mostly by himself, and Natalie, that figure, is pretty isolated. But there are communities and encampments, and these are well, one example was the L.A. Bridge People. Another is this very elaborate community in abandoned Amtrak tunnels under the streets of New York City, represented in a documentary called Dark Days by Mark Singer. And these are communities where, again, we see just human ingenuity. I mean, that's the kind of irony, is that we tend to dehumanize the homeless, but in fact, not having a home brings out what makes us human, and that is that we modify our environment, we develop domestic rituals, we are dependent on each other. So all of those things are happening, you know, under the bridges, in the tunnels, you know, in these different encampments, where you have a very complex sociality, subculture, and interdependence.
And this dehumanizing that we do, it also affects immigrants similarly, right?
Yeah, well, especially in this climate. And, you know, I think that the work that I'm doing, I didn't work specifically on refugee camps or, you know, really looking at people who've been violently dislocated. The immigrants that I look at are represented in novels, and they tend to be first and second generation immigrants who have homes. But I try to tie them to histories of dislocation. So that's obviously true in the case of a Chicana household where, you know, looking back further, there's the Mexican-American War and this ongoing dislocation, deportation, dehumanization of people from Mexican backgrounds. And I see how that influences the story of a little girl, that's sort of the backstory. That's the larger collective backstory of her personal experience.
So you talked earlier about the home being placed to learn, and maybe to learn values of work ethic, a place of labor. And then we talked about how women who do some of those tasks in the world are undervalued. So is this what started the relationship for you with feminist scholarship and activism, or what is that relationship?
No, I mean, my relationship to feminist scholarship and activism go back, you know, I think to high school. I mean, I really came of age, you know, I graduated from high school in 74. You know, I really came of age like through the second wave women's movement. And so, you know, initially the project when I got to college and majored in English was both to do a feminist critique of some male writers. You know, Kate Millett had famously in Sexual Politics taken Norman Mailer to task, taken Henry Miller to task for these really two-dimensional, you know, objectified, sexualized images of women, you know, if there were women at all. And so, you know, I was sort of part of a really exciting moment when we began to look at Moby Dick and say, why is this the great American novel? There aren't any women. There are a bunch of guys out in a ship. And people have actually talked interestingly about the homoeroticism of that. But as a sort of representative text, we've realized that we need to put, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe next to Melville. We need to put Harriet Jacobs' slave narrative next to Melville. So, and actually, I guess that does maybe tie in because what do you know? Those women are not out on a sailing ship. They're talking about, Harriet Jacobs' case, actually a domestic confinement as a slave, but then anyway, shouldn't go into the details of that story, but she ends up confined in a very small space for a long time as part of her escape. And so actually that contrasts with Frederick Douglass, who, not having children, being male, His story is one of physically overpowering his master and of just being able to take flight more easily than she could. She was hampered as a woman in various ways. And also what she wanted was a hearth of her own, which she doesn't quite get at the end. But the destination for her is to be with her family in a way that is not subject to the kind of violation that it was subject to when she was enslaved.
So we're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. We're talking with Susan Freeman about feminist theory and issues of gender and sexuality and her book, Extreme Domesticity, A View from the Margins. We'll also be talking with Tim Cunningham about his work with Clowns Without Borders, bringing laughter and resiliency to communities in crisis across the globe. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. This is Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Right now we're speaking with Susan Freeman. And so we were talking about activism and feminism. So did you want to take it from where we left off?
Yeah. So I was saying that when I was in college, it was this exciting intellectual moment, both doing a feminist critique of the male-dominated canon, the sort of so-called great works. And the second phase was recovering the works of women writers. So when I toss off the names of, you know, Harriet Jacobs and Harriet Beecher Stowe, those were not people who were taught at all, really. In fact, many of the women who were recovered, they wrote things that were possibly very popular in their day, but had since gone out of print. But you'd asked about the connection to activism, and it's important to me. I always say to my students that women's studies came out of the second wave women's movement, and that was, you know, similar pattern as with African-American studies coming out of the civil rights movement and black nationalism, you know, queer studies really coming out of, you know, Stonewall and the gay liberation movement. And so really initially, at least, women's studies, feminist theory, it was the intellectual arm of a political movement, a mass political movement, and you know, had incredible, the women's movement had incredible consequences in the academy across the disciplines that we used to, again, talk about 19th century American novel. And now the terrain looks completely different. Once we say, well, wait a minute, what were the women saying? That's true in history, part of a whole new social history, which includes not only women, but slaves and laborers, working class people. Previously, history had been the history of great men, of military leaders, of you know, presidents. So we now get kind of a people's history. So all of those different social movements just revolutionized many, many disciplines in the academy. But to me, it's still important that we remember our political roots. And for me personally, it's been important to stay engaged in more hands-on activism. I do think that the teaching that I do and the scholarship that I do, I hope that that has, I mean, I think it has political implications. I hope it has political effects. But it's been important for me to be involved in a more hands-on way. And the, of course, I went to the Women's March, which was so exhilarating in Washington. But most of my activism locally has been around the issue of living wage. And so under the rubric of, you know, concerns with labor, with social justice for workers, specifically low-paid workers at the university and in town. But what do you know? They're disproportionately women. They're disproportionately people of color. So I really see that as continuous with the work that I do around gender. And one way that our field has developed is I think it's true that initially, both politically and intellectually, there was a bias that was not always sufficiently acknowledged in favor of more privileged women. And also, we sometimes assume that we could generalize about all women this, all patriarchy that. And one way that we've really become more sophisticated and just more accurate is in appreciating differences among women and often inequalities among women, so that we need to always be looking at the ways that gender intersects with race and class and sexuality and nationality, immigrant status, all of that affects what it means to be a woman. So again, I see my living wage activism is very much tied to my feminist concerns.
Do you think the current women's movement has effectively moved the needle right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited. I think a whole, you know, the current generation has really just you know, discovered feminism and, you know, just is running with it in a way that's very exciting. And, you know, unfortunately, some of it has to do with our current president and ways that he demands resistance around gender issues and so many other issues. So we've all been galvanized by that. The Women's March obviously, you know, was a response to Trump's election. You know, in terms of what I was saying before, it was very exciting to me that women, the banner was women. Women were leading the way. Women organized that march. But many, many other issues were included. And so the heterogeneity of that and the number of issues that, you know, that could be articulated under the banner of women and feminism was really exciting to me.
Just a question back to living wage. Do you know what's going on here with that, the status of that at the university?
Yeah, well, it's still a vexed issue. I mean, I was involved in the campaign when it started in the late 90s, and so it's been a while now. Mm-hmm. And the wages have crept up. The city, actually, as a result of this campaign, became a living wage city. They passed a living wage ordinance. They've recently, I think, both upped the number. You know, at this point, we consider a livable wage, you know, there's a national fight for 15. Here, it's at least $13 an hour. The big problem at UVA, I think that the starting wage for directly employed faculty is 11 something. The problem is that much of the work is contracted out. And so those folks may be earning the minimum wage of, you know, seven something with no benefits. Mm-hmm. So any demand for living wage and the UVA living wage campaign is very, you know, insistent upon this, has to include contract employees, indirect employees, as well as direct employees. And it has to be indexed to the cost of living, because when I started, people were being paid five something and we were demanding eight. Wow. $8 was a living wage. Now, obviously, that's a poverty wage, especially in Charlottesville. So so that's where we are. And you know, it's been going on for so long. It sort of ebbed and flowed. And we even had a staff union for a while affiliated with Communication Workers of America. That was a kind of high point. But because we're a right-to-work state, it's very, you can't collectively bargain. It's very hard to sustain a union. So that petered out after about 6 years. When I started, it was really a faculty-led movement. These days, more recently, it's been a student-led movement. The most recent really moving, you know, just incredibly courageous action was the hunger strike of several years ago, which got some national coverage. And yet seemingly had well, in fact, over the summer, this is what always happens, is then over the summer, quietly, raises do go up as a result of those kinds of interventions, although there's always a denial that it had anything to do with protests. Mm-hmm. So ongoing fight, in short.
Yeah, thanks.
How did feminism and your study, interest in gender, lead you to a study of animals, and what does that reveal? What does it reveal about us?
Yeah, well, good question. Well, so one thing is I like animals, and that's not irrelevant to the article that I wrote about this, because basically ecofeminists were making the connection between not any kind of natural relation between women and animals, but the fact that both animals and women are seen as being lesser in similar ways, that they are somehow more bodily and less intellectual, and therefore sort of lower than human males. And so women, especially Carol Adams, is one of the more prominent figures. She wrote The Sexual Politics of Meat that came out in the early 1990s. Women were talking about this, tying a view of nature as something that needed to be dominated to a view of women as people who needed to be dominated. So they had, under the rubric of ecofeminism, there was a great deal of important scholarship done But it was seen as just sort of weird and wacky and not serious. And Carol Adams really was almost sort of reviled in scholarly circles. And then, what do you know, in the early 21st century, some guys came along and basically rebranded animal studies. So it's no longer like crazy women who like cats. And they even said, it's not because we like animals. This is a theoretical move that we're making that has to do with challenging human exceptionalism and challenging speciesism. But it's a really, it's a sort of philosophical project that we're involved in. It doesn't mean that we like animals. There's no emotion involved. We're not like those crazy women. And so that infuriated me. And the piece that I wrote really was saying, hey, you all are saying the same thing that these women were saying several decades ago. And yet you're denying that it has anything to do either with them, that there's an intellectual debt, that it has to do with feelings about animals, and that it has to do with the animal rights movement and activism around animals, that, again, has to do with a sense of caring and connection.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's once again, men needing to feminize what women do at all costs.
Yeah. So we're about running out of time, so I'm going to give you the chance, Susan, to ask your own question to yourself. What do you want to leave us with, if you could, just in about 30 seconds or so?
Oh, gosh.
Or something we didn't get to.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, I'm interested in Jane Austen, and I could, you know, I have taught a seminar, an entire semester on Jane Austen. You know, I guess that I like her because I see her as a kind of bad girl. I don't see her as Miss Manners. I think she is hilarious and irreverent. You know, even though all of her stories end in marriage, and I do think that we like that. We take pleasure in that. But I also think that she is very wry about the economic circumstances that require her female characters to get married. So I don't know. Read Jane Austen, but also back to what you all were talking about in the beginning. You know, go to the polls in November and change the country.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much for being here. Susan Freeman, professor in the English department at UVA. Thank you. We hope you'll come back and finish talking with us.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Okay. And coming up soon, we'll be talking with Tim Cunningham. But first, Nancy, do you have a news of note?
I do. It's about women. What do you know? The White House wants to strip federal funding to Planned Parenthood because, you know, only in America do we try to make the abortion rate go down by making it harder for women to get birth control. Their goal is to prevent any facility that receives federal family planning funds from providing abortions or mentioning a facility that does. And it reverses an Obama policy that effectively banned states and local governments from withholding federal funding for family planning services related to contraception and sexually transmitted infections, fertility, pregnancy care, cervical cancer screening from qualified health providers, regardless of whether they also perform abortions. And two-thirds of the people who visit Planned Parenthood for family planning are below the poverty line. They need Planned Parenthood, so do 41% of the women. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, surprisingly, I just want to say congratulations to Ireland today that repealed that horrific Eighth Amendment, which was one of the most restrictive bans on abortion anywhere in the developed world. They resoundingly, finally defeated it today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Great.
What do you
got? Didn't know about that. I am just going to go right to our next guest because we're running a little short in time, and I'd rather talk to Tim. At this point, so we're so glad to have Tim Cunningham here. He has traveled to 13 countries and counting, delivering laughter to communities in crisis across the globe with Clowns Without Borders. The organization brings connection through playfulness to people affected by the ravages of natural disaster, disease, and war. He's a nurse professor, and he's the director of the School of Nursing's Compassionate Care Initiative at the University of Virginia. The publication UVA Today said that he had the perfect combination of compassion, brilliance, and humor. We're glad to have you here. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Great. So I had read that that the organization started, there are many, many chapters I know all over the world, but the one I read about in 96 started when a group of clowns and artists went to Chiapas, Mexico, and it was a really tense, potentially violent time, and they were told there the artists that their presence helped de-escalate possible military aggression. And I know you were there as well in Chiapas. Can you talk a little bit about your experience there and about Clowns Without Borders?
Sure thing. So I was unfortunately not there in 96 when the work began, founded by Moshe Cohen. And it's of note to say that when Moshe started the work, working in the Zapatista communities in Chiapas, he also brought Roshi Bernie Glassman with him, who founded the Zen Peacemakers. And so when we talk about the work of Clown, people often say, why Clown? People are starving, people are dying, there's violence. It's just a waste of time to be bring clowns in. What Bernie did with Moshe, with some of the other founders of Clowns Without Borders, they really did connect with communities in a different way. And it's not to say that we had to be the ones that did it, but I think what we do with the clowns is we catalyze a different level of connection, specifically in zones of crisis, where people can look at each other differently, think about each other differently, respond differently, and often from that comes laughter. And Chiapas is a hub. So Chiapas was the first trip that I did, and I think it was 2003. I was working as a professional actor, working different regional gigs, bouncing from home to home, gig to gig, and I was invited to come and work with the clowns down there. We did a tour of some extremely rural areas. We worked with a group of nuns who actually every day would fill bags of medical gear and also communion gear, and they would walk into the most remote communities for hours, treat people both spiritually and physically, and then walk back. And sort of in the model of the barefoot doctors in China. And it was extraordinary to hear their stories. I want to put out there that we're not a religious organization, but oftentimes religious organizations, particularly these nuns, have more access and trust in certain communities. So they bring us in to share laughter. So we went in, worked for 2 weeks, and it was probably about a week in. We were performing in a rural community, and it was a Sunday afternoon. We had about 250 people watching us. We were on this basketball court doing our clown thing. I should say that most of our shows, we perform without words. Many of us do speak languages of the countries where we work, but not fluently enough, and certainly not strongly enough to tell jokes in those languages. Susan and I were talking earlier about trying to speak Creole and French, and how, you know, it's very colonial of us to go in and say, yeah, I can tell a joke in your language. So we keep it silent. We keep it physical. And in the middle of the show, I was performing with the clowns, and there was a man in the very back of the sort of the audience there on this dirt road who was in love with one of the clowns. He just couldn't take his eyes off of her the whole time. And we were connecting, and I thought, oh, this is great. And I was doing a slapstick bit where we had a newspaper. We were fighting over the newspaper back and forth. She take it from me, swat me in the head. I take it from her, swat her in the head. Everybody's laughing except for this dude in the back. And apparently he was the town drunk. We didn't know that. And he was upset with me. So he pulled out a lasso from horseback, swooped the lasso around his head over and over and over again, threw the lasso at me. As he's throwing the lasso, the crowd splits, running, screaming, and the lasso lands around my waist.
Oh, no.
I stand up. He slaps his horse. He takes off on the horse. The next thing I know, I'm able to get one leg out. I'm on my butt being dragged down a dirt road, looking at this beautiful sunset, thinking, if this is it, at least it's a beautiful day to leave this planet. But I also realize in that moment, there's some power with clown connection, and I got hooked on the work. I've not been dragged and nearly killed in other situations, but I think ultimately what we do is we connect in a strange way, and mostly it's positive. I would say 99% of the time it's positive, and that's why we do what we do, engage how we engage.
So we're going to go to a break, and we're going to come right back with this fascinating discussion about Clowns Without Borders with Tim Cunningham. Stick with us. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Our guest right now is Tim Cunningham, who was talking about a little bit about the danger. You mentioned you were lassoed and dragged down a dirt road in Chiapas, Mexico. And I know you were also nearly carjacked in South Africa. Is it dangerous to go? I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that, but I want to talk about the work. But do you find it can be dangerous in these places?
It's certainly dangerous to do the work that we do with Clowns Without Borders. Our mission is to share laughter and joy in zones of crisis. And one thing that we prioritize as an organization is not ourselves to define what that crisis is. We connect with other NGOs, other nonprofits, other groups that are working in community who reach out to us and say, we've got this going on. Can you come work with us? those places we go are mostly inherently not safe. We were working in Turkey in July of 2015, and we were, as we would perform in the evenings, we had a curfew. When the sun was down, we had to be back in the hotels where we were staying. And as the sun would go down, we would perform as often American-supported and American-made fighter jets were flying into eastern Turkey to threaten and bomb Kurds living within Turkey. But while that was happening, we had crowds of hundreds of children laughing at our show, and often the laughter drowned out the thunder of the jets. It is dangerous where we go, but we believe that when crisis occurs, you know, think about what's lost when crisis occurs and who loses out first. Generally, it's children, it's women, and the elderly. Those who may already be voiceless have even less of a voice. We prioritize going where we're invited, and we do our best to get to where we're invited because we do believe in this power of connectional laughter. So the danger is worth it.
Mm-hmm. Clearly.
And Tim, how difficult can it be to make these kids feel safe enough or free enough to laugh, given the circumstances you've already described?
It's fascinating. And I want to state that we don't make kids or make people do anything. I would argue that we catalyze it. I would argue that as humans, we're inherently resilient and we have the capacity to let that arise. And I think that's what's beautiful about a clown or a pantomime or an artist who doesn't use language and words to express themselves. We do things that let these emotions rise. One example is we were flown into the Philippines shortly after Typhoon Yolanda. Most of the world called it Haiyan, but in the Philippines, they named the typhoon Yolanda. Over 6,000 people died in a matter of hours. And we were doing clown shows with kids on top of rubble where these children had lost their homes, where they had lost their families, where they had lost everything. And within minutes of the start of our clown performance, these kids were laughing, they were playing. We had to do some crowd control to keep them from running up on stage playing with us directly. When you looked at these kids, you had no idea what their past was. So I think we're all, in many ways, hungry for it. And so as clowns, we try to catalyze that. And it's really remarkable about how it arises. And often we forget that we're in a zone of crisis when we're in the show, when we're in the moment, when we're all together seeing each other and playing.
So you're a nurse and you're concerned with healing. And what we're talking, I think, about here is the healing power of laughter and connection.
Absolutely.
So can you talk about how that helps people become healthier and that concept of resiliency?
Sure thing. So there's a growing body of evidence and research and literature. One, simply looking at clowns and looking at the effects of clowns, specifically hospital clowns. There is some evidence that show that when a hospital clown interacts with a child appropriately, and I want to make sure that's clear, A, not everyone's a clown. B, to be a clown takes high levels of training. C, to be a hospital clown takes even higher levels of training. So if I give you a wig and a nose, that doesn't mean you're funny. It means you're probably scary. It means you're probably fulfilling that bigger stereotype of scary clowns. Good clowns doing good work, we see that children who experience that often require less pain medication, report lower levels of anxiety. Their parents or guardians who are with them also report lower levels of anxiety. So as we talk about the healing powers of laughter, it's really tough to measure. And yet it suggests that as we laugh, we need less of these allopathic medications, these other treatments that we know also cause harm and have negative side effects. We also know that when you laugh, your cortisol drops, your testosterone drops, stress hormones decrease in your body. And there's also some evidence that as you laugh, well, think about exercise. When you exercise, your heart rate goes up, your respirations change, and you break down muscle, you build muscle. In many ways, laughter is similar at a much lower level. But if you're super sick and you're breathing, you still have the potential to laugh and therefore can exercise a little bit and strengthen yourself.
Mm-hmm. And how did all of these trips you made around the world affect your medical, you know, your career in medicine? Because I know you have RN and MSN. Anyway, how did that all affect your work afterwards?
Sure. As a nurse, I have a lot of confusing letters behind my name, and nurses just seem to do that. I don't even know half the letters that my nurse colleagues have. We like letters. So I never thought I would be a nurse. In fact, my father said, don't do anything in healthcare because it's gross and it's going to burn you out. And now I research burnout and compassion in nursing. I wanted to be an actor. I was performing for almost a decade, regional theaters, the work with Clowns Without Borders, volunteering with Clowns Without Borders. It's a volunteer organization. And I was working in a rural hospital in Okai, Haiti in 2006. And we were performing for kids. We were invited by the Cuban doctors and nurses to come in and perform. And we witnessed the death of a child, a young girl who was a few weeks old. She was born malnourished. Her mother didn't have enough food while her mother was pregnant. And the child died. And witnessing that death physically shook me. And I said, what the hell am I doing just juggling here in front of people? I want to do more. I want to understand more. And why did this child die in this country that's only a couple hours off the shores of the U.S., where we have people dying of overnutrition, overconsumption, obesity, and this woman can't get enough food? So I went back to school to study nursing and global health. And also to look at the connections of laughter and playfulness. I was a pediatric emergency nurse for years and would often carry magic tricks with me in my scrub pockets. So as we're starting IVs, can I distract a child with a magic trick rather than having to give them intranasal medication to sedate them so we can get an IV started? Through that, and as I was more interested in global health, I got my doctorate in global health so I could do more research on the connections of laughter, joy, now looking at compassion. And how can we use laughter maybe as a tool to decrease burnout among nurses, among physicians, among actors, among everyone, among community?
So we talked a little bit beforehand about why is failure funny? Can you talk about that? I don't think we got into it enough, and I'm curious.
Failure is the best. When you think about clown, truly funny clowns, and you see them trip, you see them fall, you see them get distracted and run into a wall, that's failure. And that makes us all laugh. Now, there's some types of comedy where we're outwardly making fun of people, and that can get kind of gross and kind of harsh. With Clowns Without Borders, we try to avoid that kind of comedy. We keep our comedy accidental, but it's always trying to get on to the next thing. And we just inherently laugh at it. And yet, as an academic now, working in research, we don't laugh at failure the same way. And I think we take ourselves way too seriously. One of my advisors said, you know, academia is funny. It's the stress is so high because often the stakes are so low. And we should be able to laugh at that. And I think be with that. We should have journals that publish our failures as well. And we can say, hey, nice try. But inherently, we that helps us engage when we see someone else fail, especially if it's the other. And the clown is a great other. It's not community members that we trust that are failing in front of us, making us laugh. It's these strangers, these foreigners who come in that do this wacky thing, and they remind us that we still can laugh.
This resiliency that you stress, stress is probably the wrong word that you focus on. Does that also include the healthcare workers themselves that, you know, have to go to these places and put on a brave face and focus on, you know, taking these kids and making them laugh, giving them space to laugh, excuse me. But is there any effect on the healthcare workers themselves from doing this work?
There's tremendous effect on the healthcare workers. During 2014, 2015, I took some time away from my dissertation and worked as a frontline nurse in Sierra Leone during the Ebola crisis, working with nurses and doctors treating pediatric adult patients. We saw extreme suffering, extreme death, and I found that when we were in the Ebola treatment units, that there were moments of laughter between us as colleagues. I would try to bring little magic tricks into the unit. We literally had some children on their deathbeds laughing and playing with each other as they took their last breaths. Providers saw that. Providers left with that. And when we would come home and debrief, those are the things that we talked about, as much as talking about how hard this is, how awful this is, how the world is not paying attention to Ebola. There's another outbreak in the DRC right now. But it was laughter and camaraderie that brought us together. Ultimately, I would argue that if healthcare providers, nurses, physicians, social workers, chaplains do not take care of themselves and have their own resilience practice, they are not going to be the compassionate providers we would expect them to be to take care of ourselves, our mothers, our grandmothers, our fathers, our sisters, our brothers. So it sounds a little bit selfish, but it's not. Self-care and resilience needs to happen at the provider level so that we can be more generous and compassionate towards others. And that's what we do with the Compassionate Care Initiative.
So Clowns Without Borders, I read that they have an education program as well, offering lesson plans to students and communities. So the ones I read about were empathy and active listening, learning about internal displacement, human migration, and the most relevant now, I think, to gain awareness of what quality of life is like for child refugees. Did you have any interaction with that, or can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I've helped mentor building some of these educational programs. And by the way, I love giving presentations to schools, churches, communities, any community group that wants to learn more about Clowns Without Borders. The education program is sort of two-tiered. One is presence, and two is advocacy. With presence, we know that the more present you are as a learner, as a student, as a non-student, the more you're going to be able to take in and be attuned to your surroundings so that you can respond and react appropriately. And as we train, we hope compassionately. Advocacy is also key to us because we realize what Fox News tells us is not really what's going on. I know I'm preaching to the choir on this radio show, but we try to advocate for the communities and share the stories of what we witness with the community members who are inherently voiceless because of the systems and the world they live in. So with our education programs, we teach learners about the countries we're working in. Why are we here? What are the reasons that brought us here? And what are some ideas for change? And then you also play games to practice presence and practice deep listening so that as the learners that we work with grow, hopefully they can be better human beings and more attentive to the world around them.
That's really great. Just so you would you do that here if someone approached you?
I would love to do that here. I've done that at a couple schools a few years ago, came into town. I would love to do that. We offer our services if it's a public school, a smaller program, we offer our services for free. If you're a city core and you have a little money to give, we do charge, but we take that money and give that to Clowns Without Borders to support our programming.
And just a chance to mention the website of the international group. It's clownswithoutborders.org. And what about getting in touch with you? Would they just Google you?
Mm-hmm. They could Google me, Tim okay. Cunningham. You can email me, Tim, T-I-M, at clownswithoutborders.org. Clowns Without Borders is all one word.
Mm-hmm. And we'll put that on the website.
Please do.
Yeah, we will do that.
And Tim, you've also hosted, at least last summer, a clown camp. I was wondering, are you still doing that sort of thing?
We did host a clown camp here last summer as a part of the Heritage Festival at University of Virginia. We are not going to do that again this year. We actually, and this is information I hope my board isn't upset with me for sharing, we are trying to look at building a conference in Charlottesville in 2019 on humanitarian clowning and potentially hospital clowning. There was one in Vienna this past April, And we'd like to continue that because people are afraid of clowns in the U.S., and rightfully so. People like Stephen King, John Wayne Gacy. I mean, there are some problematic clowns out there. But when you look at real clowning, trained artists, it's magical. And if I have time, I'd love to tell a brief story
yes.
on why that's magical. Shortly after the Haiti earthquake, Clowns Without Borders was invited to come in and start performing in the newly forming camps, refugee camps for internally displaced Haitians who had lost everything. And oftentimes we get invitations as soon as a crisis hits and we say, whoa, 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 we got to make sure water, shelter, medicine is here. The NGOs we work with, they say, yep, we know we're working on that. But we also know that we need to bring in things that can change people's minds and for a brief moment take their minds off of what's going on. Clowns went into Haiti. Many of the clowns were staying in tents near the camps, had limited meals, limited foods, but we said, we'll go, we'll do what we can. Clowns were performing in a hospital setting, community setting, hospital setting, and they were doing their thing. They had a group of nurses and physicians, psychologists watching them, and of course, the audience members. And one of the tricks that we do in some of our clown shows, we have a little handkerchief, and a clown sneezes, gets stuck on their fingers, it's full of snot, they can't get off their fingers, do acrobatics trying to pull off their fingers, and then magically the handkerchief disappears. And then it comes out from another clown's hand, and then it disappears again, and then it comes out from behind the ear of an audience member, and then it just keeps disappearing and reappearing. As we do our clown shows, we're always trying to connect with audience members that we think might want to come up on stage and interact with us. Clowns were doing that. They saw a girl in the audience, 7-year-old girl, who was really connecting with them. Handkerchief disappeared. They went up. They pulled it out from behind her ear, and she laughed. And the clowns kept doing their thing. But when she laughed, some of the psychologists in the group stood back and had a strange reaction. As clowns, as improv artists, we're always gauging our audiences, right? So clowns went on, they finished their show, and at the end of the show, they went up to the providers that had that reaction and said, did we do something wrong? You had a strange reaction. We want to make sure we're not causing harm. We can change our show if we need. And the provider said, the girl that you chose, why did you choose her? They said, well, we connected with her. She was smiling. We thought she'd be good to help us with this magic trick. And it worked. You know, everybody laughed. They said, well, we found her 3 days after the earthquake. She was buried under the rubble. We recovered her. She was laying next to her mother who had died probably shortly right after. She was petrified. She was mortified. She was basically catatonic. We've had her here for a few weeks. This is the first time we've seen her smile. This is the first time we've seen her engage. This is the first time we've seen her laugh from that one trick. That's what we're all about.
Well, powerful story about Clowns Without Borders. You can go visit the website at thatname.org. Thank you so much, Tim, for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you, Susan. I hope everyone goes and learns a little bit more about that organization. And you can contact Tim if you want some personal contact. So, Nance, are you there?
I am.
We barely have any time. We don't have time, but...
No, I'm online reading about Clowns Without Borders.
That was such a moving story. I'm just like, you know, I don't even know what to do, but do you want to do a palate cleanser?
Anyway,
we have
no time. No.
We're not going to do it. Well, thanks everyone again. That was wonderful talking to you guys, Susan and Tim. Susan Freeman, Tim Cunningham. Our theme music is by Springtide, and thank you to Nance. We'll see you next week. Thanks, Nance.
Yep. Sure. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham Team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.